important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Trump stormed our house with the mob he incited, and we defended our house. And he violated our Constitution, and we defended the Constitution. And they tried to trash our democracy, and we revived it, and we protected it.
Democratic lawmakers have announced plans to set up a 9/11 commission-style panel to investigate the deadly insurrection at the Capitol on January 6. We'll speak with Nation journalist Elie Mystal about why he wants to see Donald Trump in jail. And then we'll talk to Ecuadorian presidential candidate Andrés Arauz, a protege of former President Rafael Correa. Arauz won the first round of the election after vowing to fight austerity, poverty, and the pandemic.
There is no doubt. We are in first place. We have received an overwhelming vote from different parts of our country. As I said earlier, it is a victory representative of the entire national territory.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has authorized a 9/11-style commission to further investigate the January 6th insurrection, as well as the actions that led up to it. This comes as calls are growing for the criminal prosecution of former President Donald Trump as one of the last paths left to hold him accountable after Saturday's vote in the Senate fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to find him guilty. 7 Republicans voted with Democrats to convict, among them North Carolina Senator Richard Burr. On Monday, North Carolina's Republican Party formally censured Burr over his vote, joining similar votes against Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Republican officials in Maine and Utah are also considering censure votes against Susan Collins and Mitt Romney over their votes to convict Trump. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the fight to hold Trump accountable for the insurrection and the fight within the Republican Party over Trump's legacy. A massive Arctic air mass settled over the central United States Monday, spawning deadly accidents, leaving millions without power, breaking records for snowfall and low temperatures from Nebraska to Oklahoma to Texas. In Houston, 1.4 million people remained without electricity for a second straight day after Houston recorded an all-time record low of just 17 degrees. This is Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner.
It is a system-wide failure across the state. These are not rolling blackouts. These are power outages at a huge, unprecedented scale.
Climate scientists say severe winter weather has become much more frequent as the Arctic warms rapidly due to human activity. The United States recorded 989 deaths from COVID-19 Monday as the daily death toll fell below 1,000 for the first time since November. The 7-day average of new cases has dropped from January's high to less than 100,000 per day, but remains higher than a second surge of U.S. infections seen last summer. In Louisiana, officials have canceled Mardi Gras events, including today's Fat Tuesday celebration, 1 year after Mardi Gras became an early super spreader event. here in New York. Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing an investigation for not initially reporting close to half the 15,000 coronavirus deaths at nursing homes and other long-term care facilities during the pandemic. On Monday, Cuomo acknowledged his role but stopped short of an apology.
We should have provided more information faster. We were too focused on doing the job and addressing the crisis of the moment, and we did not do a good enough job in providing information. I take total responsibility for that.
Republican state senators are calling for Governor Cuomo's impeachment. They're also demanding a special session to strip Cuomo of his emergency powers, a call that at least 14 Democratic state senators have joined. Democrat Jessica Ramos tweeted, quote, "People died and Cuomo lied. Then he had the gall to write a book," she said. It's a reference to Cuomo's bestseller, American Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic, which does not include information on how many New York nursing home residents died of coronavirus. The World Health Organization has granted emergency use authorization to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. It's just the second vaccine after Pfizer's to be approved for the WHO's COVAX initiative aimed at bringing vaccines to lower-income countries across the world. On Monday, the new head of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, warned against vaccine nationalism, saying attempts by wealthier nations to hoard vaccines would backfire.
The pandemic is a problem of the global commons. So taking care of your population and being nationalistic with respect to vaccines won't work this time.
The new head of the WTO is Nigeria's former finance minister and managing director of the World Bank. On Monday, she became the first woman and the first African appointed to lead the World Trade Organization. In northern Iraq, a civilian contractor was killed. 9 people were injured Monday in a rocket attack on a U.S. military base in the city of Erbil, the capital of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region in the north. A little-known Shia organization calling itself Guardians of Blood claimed responsibility, promising it would carry out more attacks targeting the U.S. occupation. The New York Times reports Taliban fighters have surrounded major population centers across Afghanistan as the Biden administration weighs whether to honor an agreement with the Taliban to withdraw the remaining 2,500 U.S. troops by May 1st. On Monday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the U.S.-led military alliance is not ready to withdraw from Afghanistan.
While no ally wants to stay in Afghanistan longer than necessary, we will not leave before the time is right.
Earlier this month, a congressionally appointed panel known as the Afghanistan Study Group recommended the Biden administration should renege on its agreement to withdraw from Afghanistan by May. The U.S. is removing Yemen's Houthi rebels from the government's list of foreign terrorist organizations, reversing a last-minute move by the Trump administration, which Yemenis and international aid groups warned would only worsen the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. This comes as the U.N. warns hundreds of thousands of children in Yemen could die this year from severe acute malnutrition unless they receive urgent care. The World Food Program cut food rations to millions last year due to a lack of funds. This is Abdul Malik al-Wahedi, the head of a Sana Hospital malnutrition ward.
There are several reasons for the increase in malnutrition. For example, the withdrawal of aid organizations, the rise in price of oil, organizations that no longer provide medication, basic nutrition needs, food aid, especially in conflict zones.
In the Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara, renowned Sahrawi activist Sultana Khaya was brutally assaulted last weekend by Moroccan agents in her home in the city of Boujdour, where she and her entire family have been held under house arrest since last November 19th, days after the renewal of armed conflict in the territory. On February 13th, Sultana was waving a large flag from a rooftop when the police commissioner of Boujdour hurled a rock and struck her in the head. Videos and photographs of the assault and of Khaya's head injuries went viral. The next day, dozens of Sahrawi women approached the family home in solidarity, but were beaten away by police. As Sultana protested her house arrest, the same police officer struck her in the back of her neck with a nightstick, and she again passed out. Khaya's family is worried about her injuries, but say Morocco-run hospitals are not safe places for Sahrawi activists, and police have not allowed the family to summon a doctor to the house. In 2016, Democracy Now! Interviewed Sultana Khaya for our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. You can watch the film at democracynow.org. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 60 people were killed and hundreds more remain missing after an overloaded ferry boat capsized in the Congo River. Officials say the modified whaling vessel had about 700 passengers on board and that so far only 300 survivors have been found. Palestinian authorities say Israel's halted the shipment of 2,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the Gaza Strip, where they were due to be administered to frontline medical workers. The besieged territory is home to more than 2 million people, but has yet to receive any vaccine. This comes as Israeli health officials reported a nearly 95% drop in symptomatic coronavirus infections among 600,000 Israelis who received Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, and 30% of Israeli citizens have received at least one vaccine dose, the highest rate of any major nation. But that figure excludes Palestinians in the occupied territories who remain largely unvaccinated. Back in the United States, a federal appeals court has thrown out an Arkansas state law prohibiting government contractors from participating in boycotts of Israel, ruling it violates their First Amendment rights. In a statement celebrating the ruling, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, known as CARE, said, quote, just as African Americans had the constitutional right to participate in the Montgomery bus boycott, and just as anti-apartheid activists had the constitutional right to boycott South Africa's government, every American has the constitutional right to boycott the Israeli government over its human rights abuses of Palestinians, CARE wrote. A warning to our audience, the next stories contain disturbing images and descriptions of violence. In Missouri, the city of St. Louis is paying a $5 million settlement to a black police officer who was assaulted by white officers in 2017 while working undercover at an anti-police brutality protest. Luther Hall was reportedly thrown to the ground, kicked and beaten with a baton, leaving him severely injured. In a lawsuit filed in 2019, Hall says the white officers then tried to cover up the assault. At least 4 officers involved in the attack were federally indicted in 2018. In California, an investigation is underway after a Los Angeles police officer reported fellow officers made and circulated a Valentine's Day meme with an image of George Floyd and the words, "You take my breath away." L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon wrote on Twitter, quote, celebrating the murder of a black man at the hands of police demonstrates a profound absence of humanity, unquote. Last summer, massive racial justice protests erupted across the country and the world in response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. A viral video shows white police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes while Floyd repeatedly gasped for air and said, "I can't breathe." In New Jersey, advocates are demanding the firing of 2 Paterson police officers involved in the beating of a Muslim Arab American teen this past December. Osama Al-Saidi, who was 19 at the time of the assault, posted the video on social media. The video shows officers Kevin Patino and Marcos Martinez apprehending Al-Saidi while he's walking. One of the officers is seen repeatedly punching Al-Saidi, who is then tackled to the ground, where the officers continue to beat him. Al-Saidi was reportedly later diagnosed with a concussion and head trauma. The Council on American-Islamic Relations said in a statement, quote, to see such a reprehensible attack happen at the hands of those who supposedly serve and protect Paterson residents is more than disheartening. It's revolting and deserving of immediate punishment, Kerr said. The New Jersey Attorney General's Office has launched an investigation. And in Guatemala, dozens of girls and women led a bike caravan in Guatemala City Saturday, protesting skyrocketing violence against women, children and youth in the country. The protesters rode their bikes to the Constitutional Plaza, lining up in front of the presidential palace, where they were met with police. Chants of "We just want to play in peace" echoed through the crowd of young girls.
No more missing girls. We demand justice.
Protests erupted following the recent killing of 8-year-old Sharon Figueroa. Her body was found last week in a northern region of Guatemala after she went missing for 2 days. In 2020 alone, nearly 500 femicides were reported in Guatemala, and at least 60 children were killed. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will be sunny with a high of minus 10 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be mainly cloudy with a high of minus 9 degrees Celsius. Friday there will be snow and a high of minus 7 degrees Celsius. Saturday brings a mix of sun and clouds and a high of minus 5 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be mainly sunny with a high of minus 7 degrees Celsius. Monday there will be a light snow and a high of minus 1 degree Celsius. Tuesday there will be flurries and a high of 0 degrees Celsius. Well, that wraps up the show for today. We'll see you again next week. Keep listening to CKUT.
Sunshine, rain, it all, you don't. My art wears a mask.
My art wears a mask.
My art wears a mask.
This is a special series by Ravel.ca with emerging artists, talking about their challenges and successes during this time of the pandemic.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of Ravel.ca's series, My Art Wears a Mask. I'm Victoria Fenner. Today we're going to hear two conversations with two classical musicians and also some really fabulous music. Today's guests are both string players. Maxime Despax is a viola player whose family home is in Gatineau, Quebec, and he's studying in Toronto right now. Yannick Campbell is a violinist who was born in Cuba. She's studying at the Glenn Gould Studio of the Royal Conservatory of Music, also in Toronto. Musicians are especially hard hit by the pandemic. Live music, which is the lifeblood of most performers, has come to a standstill. What you'll hear from both of our guests today are stories of adaptability. And in case you're wondering how music is happening, it's happening in the virtual space. Our guests have some insights about how that all works, too.
Music is about sharing and experiencing with other people what you're doing. But now this has been taken away, so you have to motivate yourself, inspire yourself all the time, which is doable, but exhausting.
I'm glad, the government has taken off those, have put all those restrictions in place to protect us. And that's, what needs to be done.
That was an excerpt from a piece of music that Maxime Despax and composer Benjamin Harry Sajo gave us permission to play. It's called Love Song, Prelude for Viola. It's just a sample. After the interview's over, we'll play the whole piece for you. Promise. But first, let's hear from Maxime. Maxime is from Gatineau, Quebec, and plays in a number of ensembles, or at least he did before the pandemic, including a string quartet comprised of Maxime and his three brothers and sisters. The ensemble was formed in 2003, and before the pandemic, they played concerts in Canada and in Europe. I'll let Maxime start the conversation by telling us about his music.
Yeah, so basically, I'm a violist. I'm a performer, mainly. I'm also a student still. I study at U of T doing my DMA doctorate in viola. And I also have two quartets, one with my family members. We're together since 2003. And we have a series of concerts that we do at Gatineau, my hometown. And then we gig around and play concerts around too in America and also outside the country. I also have another quartet, interior string quartet, that were based in Toronto, and that's because I'm in Toronto and a bunch of friends, we gig around with the quartet as well. Before COVID, I had multiple concerts and gigs planned, but they got all canceled. Since then, I have maybe done one or two concerts, and they weren't even with my quartets. They were with pickup groups that were able to live stream together. But other than that, it's very weird to not be able to perform a lot. It's a real tough times for performers, especially because we have to either live stream or do recordings. That's pretty much what we can do. During COVID, what happened is that I got a friend who gave my name to some people from actually BC. And they were like looking for players that would love to record a certain piece. It was for piano and orchestra. So what they did, the pianist, it was for two piano and orchestra. The pianist played their part and recorded it together. And then they sent that part to everybody. And individually, we listened to the track. And while we were listening to the track, we also recorded our part with their part. So everybody sent their own recording, and then someone did the mixing. So that's what happened during COVID, right?
So what is that experience like for you as a performer, performing in isolation to a click track, rather than being there with other musicians?
Definitely different. It's not like I haven't done it before. It's not anything new. It's just the only thing we can do. That's what I think bothers, or rather saddened, most musicians. Because music is about sharing and experiencing with other people what you're doing. But now this has been taken away, so you have to motivate yourself, inspire yourself all the time, which is doable, but exhausting. And I remember when I got a concert about two or three weeks ago. It was a small concert with a trio with two other people. And, you know, a trio is not like violin, viola, and cello. And trio is not a big formation. We don't often play in that formation. But when we did that concert, I remember the two other members, they were, I was also thrilled because it's the first time in so long that we performed for people and the energy was there. There was energy to feed off from. But when you're alone, and in my case, living in your basement and recording and trying to practice, it's very difficult to get that sense of motivation of or inspiration.
Right. So when you did that live concert just a couple of weeks ago, what was your positioning like on the stage? Did you have to alter where you sit and how you interact with each other?
Yeah, that's funny because we had to keep the 6 feet apart because we were not in the same bubble. And when we rehearsed the same thing, we had to rehearse in a big space. And funny enough, you know, we would never play like that in real life. But we were really happy to play together. And it also made it for us to listen more for each other, because in music, you know, when you play in a group, you know, your ears are the most important thing. You want to listen to what the other people say, do and play, so you can react and have some kind of like chemistry with them. But because we were so far apart, we had to pay even more attention. So it was, in the sense of a good experience, it just wasn't comfortable at all. But it was still like something that we really enjoyed to do.
Right. Well, what about the experience for the audience?
There was an audience because it was a very big church and they allowed only, I think, 20 to 30 people to come in. But like the church could hold up at least 500 or 1,000 people. So there was only 20 people in that church. It was good for us because seeing people, you know, we can feel that energy. The only thing is that it feels like the audience also forgot how to be an audience, because when we went on stage, you know, usually you go in and then people clap and then you bow. And then after that, you sit down and play, right? And they clap. They stop clapping after you sit down. Well, when we went in, nobody clapped.
So
we were like, we're like, should we bow? So we still did. We bowed. And then the organizer, who was like at the second floor of the church, she started clapping to make sure that people understood that they could clap. So after that, they clapped. With everything happening with COVID, especially for us musicians, we don't know what we can do. So we're like, should we do this? Should we do that? I'm not going to do anything just to make sure I don't break any rules.
Right. But there are no rules anymore, it seems like sometimes, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So what about the economics of the situations now? Because, you know, how on earth can musical organizations continue to support themselves if they can only have small audiences? Do you have any thoughts on that?
For people that are members of big organizations like big orchestras, it's a bit easier for them because they have like, I'm guessing, I don't know for certain, but they have like guarantees of like either pay or like getting used. Like I know the TSO still do some concerts, right? So the musicians are still getting used. I don't know how much they're getting paid or how the ones that are not used getting paid. The thing is, for freelancer musicians, nothing is guaranteed, so we basically just lost work. We have to resort to teaching. All my friends that are also freelancers are basically teaching most of the time, most for the income. I'm pretty sure we can still perform if we respect those COVID protocols. And if people would hire us for that, everybody would jump on the opportunity. You know, it's weird because except for recordings, I haven't been hired for many live streams. All live streams are basically done by the musician itself themselves. So we basically have to not only perform, but be our own bosses now and hire ourselves, which is fine because we can do it, but it's just a lot of work. And economically, it's really not that viable unless you go viral.
So what have been the most successful things that you've done to bring yourself through COVID, you know, both in terms of your lifestyle, your art, and also economically?
Well, lifestyle-wise, it was hard at the beginning because, you know, it went from 0 to 100, staying home and do nothing. And I live in a basement, so sometimes I don't see the day go by. But what I try to do is have a routine, you know, like everybody else. We take the advice of the government or anything that we can get on the internet. So having a routine really helps. And so I try to run most of the days in the morning and not go to bed later than like midnight. So having a routine is really good. Practicing, I still have a thesis to write. So planning when I write and when I don't write, and that helped a lot. In terms of economically, I had to get more students, a lot more. I used to have maybe 4 per day, per week. Now I have over 10 because that's how I can survive, right?
And do you teach them all online?
Yes.
That's a whole different scenario too, isn't it? Like music teachers having to adapt, demonstrating on instruments, but you can't actually be there. That must be pretty tough.
It's very tough. It's really like sometimes I just wish I was there to correct their position, but you know, it's you have to get really good with your words at describing what they should feel and what they should see and how they should execute it. It took practice, but like it's doable. And the thing, like I said in the beginning, musicians, we're really adaptable, and that's because we're musicians. You know, like you'll play, let's say you play an orchestra, you play like the theme or whatever, and then the conductor will say, stop, can you play this more like this and this and this? And then we have to do it on the spot, right? That's the whole point of getting an orchestra and being efficient. So we train our lives to be that flexible. And basically, when COVID happened, it was basically like, musicians, be flexible. And like, okay. And then my friend went viral on TikTok. I know people who became just streamers, and I even know people who they started doing almost unrelated, but they started doing transcriptions instead of performing. So not only do we adapt in our teaching, we adapt in everything. And we also have to adapt to the students who prefer whatever platform, right? So I teach on Skype, I teach on Zoom, I teach on even FaceTime. So it's I had to learn all, well, it's not a big learn, but I had to learn how they all work and how to make the most of it for the sound quality and the delay for when I show stuff or when they play for me.
Wow, that's a lot. One thing that I'm very curious about, too, is your string quartet with the rest of your family.
Yeah, so basically, we've been together since 2003, and that's more than 15 years. And I'm the youngest. I have two older sisters, the oldest plays violin, the second oldest plays cello, and then I have one brother who plays the violin. And we played together forever. We had a concert series in Gatineau in our church where we perform a lot. And we had 5 concerts a year, basically, all the time. Plus other concerts if we get hired in the city. But we also, we played in South America. We played in Europe. We played like France, Italy, Colombia. We also performed in the U.S. Our main country of operation is in Canada, right? We performed a lot in Ontario and a lot in Quebec. Like we haven't performed together since February, I think. I used to see them at least once or twice a month, and now I see them every 3 months. Almost 4 months.
I guess you'd have to make a choice, considering everybody's time is limited and you're probably in different places. With the limited amounts of time we can get together, do you get together with your family for a visit or do you get together with your family for a rehearsal?
It's true. We have to decide that. But usually we combine both, like family and rehearsal, because I'll stay longer to see the family and or stay longer to rehearse more. But with everything that happened, you know, I'm in Toronto, they're all in Quebec, and, you know, it's discouraged. It's not advised to travel too much, so I don't travel. And also my brother just had a baby during COVID. Well, his wife had a baby, and the baby is 7 months old now. For me, I would feel bad if, you know, I traveled back to see the baby. God knows, like, I bring something to him. I don't want to be like that, right? So why don't go that much often? And we don't have a reason to perform yet. We don't. So there's no reason for me to go yet. We have a concert plan in December, but that's going to be the first time we get together to play since February.
That was violist Maxime Despax talking about how he's been adapting his musical practice in these difficult times. Since Maxime ended the conversation by talking about his quartet with his brothers and sisters, I'll play you something recorded by the quartet now. Even more special, this piece was written by the Despax family's late father, Emmanuel Despax. Here now is the first movement of Fantasy for String Quartet. It features Maxime and his siblings, Sandrine, Valerie, and Emmanuel. Thank you. that was Fantasy for String Quartet. It features Maxime, Sandrine, Valerie, and Emmanuel Despax. The piece was written by their late father, Emmanuel Despax. Next, we'll hear from Janet Campbell-Sicades, also a string player. Born in Cuba, she's an accomplished soloist, chamber, and orchestral musician. Her skilled and sensitive playing has enabled her to perform not just in some of the most important venues in Cuba, but throughout Europe and the Caribbean. She received her Master's of Music from Memorial University in Newfoundland, and she's currently in the first year of the Artist Diploma Program at the Glenn Gould School at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. I started with the question everybody's asking everybody else these days. How are you doing through all this?
Well, I would say pretty good so far. It's a hard time for everyone, but I would say pretty good because I'm healthy and, you know, I have a place to stay and I'm doing just fine. But yeah, it's been a little bit difficult starting with, you know, when COVID, all the outbreak started, I was finishing my master's and I was supposed to do my second year, my final recital. And we couldn't do the recital because of, you know, like it wasn't possible to gather so many people for the recitals, you know, like it wasn't possible also to hold in-person rehearsals with your pianist. So that was, you know, a great impact for my, the ending of my master's. You know, no one was able to do a recital. That was one of the things. Also, you know, like as musicians, we are used to playing in an orchestra, meeting with friends to just play some music or going out a lot. And, you know, that hasn't been possible for a lot of months now. So that's not so great. But yeah, I'm really glad that I'm able to be still at the Glenwood School and they are doing their best to, you know, keep us safe. And, you know, like most of the classes are online. But we have been also we've been able to have some chamber music rehearsals, you know, with of course a few people, some in-person lessons. So that's been great, you know.
You are a violinist, right? So you're used to playing with large ensembles. Like you played with Newfoundland Symphony last year,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I used to play with a symphony orchestra.
You would have been playing with Newfoundland Symphony when the first COVID wave started coming through, like last March, right?
Yeah, we were rehearsing for a concert, and no one knew what was going to happen. We were just expecting to go through with the concerts, but suddenly, you know, everything got suspended, and we couldn't go through with the concert. We couldn't do it. So, you know, everyone was disappointed, but. Anyway, I'm glad, you know, like the government has taken off those, you know, like have put all those restrictions in place to protect us. And that's, you know, what needs to be done. But I mean, you know, as a musician, it's unfortunate because we want to play and we want to make music together.
I would think, too, that the orchestral form is one of the most compromised types of music because it requires a big stage. It requires big audiences. So are you worried and concerned about what is going to happen to orchestral music because of COVID?
Well, I would say, a little bit. You know, like at the beginning, we were all, in general, people is try to remain positive and think that this is going to, you know, like pass soon. This is going to be over soon. But who knows? Nobody knows, you know. So like, yeah. But I do have friends who work in professional orchestras, and they've been without work for many months, you know. And some of them have had to find some other ways, you know, like to survive and to make music, and you know, like through social media. Online projects.
I guess one of the most difficult things with orchestras too is that it's a struggle to get audiences because the cost of putting on an orchestral concert you need a certain size of hall. So I don't know. Like what do you think is going to come of all of this?
Well, this is very uncertain to me. I'm not completely sure what's going to happen. You know, like. For example, at Glenwood, we were expecting to do a concert. Like last week, we started rehearsing for a concert, and we were hoping to. It wasn't going to be with an audience. We were hoping to record a concert, and you know, like then distribute it through the online platform. But you know, like anyway, we cannot be together that much people in the same room. So I'm not pretty sure what's going to happen. I know, like, when all this started, orchestras started creating projects online where every musician would play their part, would record their part from home, and then they would put everything together. So that's one of the things that people have, like, orchestras have been trying to do to keep the orchestra alive. But yeah, I don't really know how long can that go on, and if it's, you know, if it's something that would work long term.
Right. So what kind, have you been doing a lot of online work and sort of recording for online concerts too, or have you been able to get together with other musicians physically in the same space?
Yeah, I haven't been doing a lot of online things, but I have been able to get together with other musicians. As I mentioned before, we had a first, concert with a school orchestra, and we even had an audience. It was a small audience. It would play for the school donors. And anyway, the concert was recorded. It was a great concert. It was recorded, and then they distributed it online. And it was very great. You know, we were all, every musician with their own stand, being like 6 feet away from each other, wearing masks. Even the winds had like this, I think it's like glass sheets in front of them. You know, like each of them was like kind of in a cage. So that was really great. We also didn't use a conductor. So Jonathan Crowe was a concert master, and he also kind of directed all the rehearsals and put everything together. So that was great. And, you know, yeah, we were very happy with the concert, but that's what we did. But right now we are not even able to get together. We were having a concert last week, and that's not possible anymore. We are too many to be together in the same room.
And how is this affecting you, not being able to get together with people in the isolation and everything?
Yeah, I would say sometimes it's overwhelming, I would say. But the part that affects me more, if not knowing what's going to happen next, you know, I'm really excited about my program. I'm really super happy to be studying at Glengall and to play with my friends who make music, you know. But yeah, what makes me more nervous is not knowing what's going to happen next, because right now I'm still, you know, we are still having classes, some lessons, and my private lessons are in person at school. Just worried, you know, like we recently went back in the, you know, to lockdown. What happens is school closes, or, you know, if things just get worse. So, but anyway, I'm trying to be positive. You know, whatever happens is going to be fine. And yeah, we are going to survive this.
You're of Cuban background, right?
Yes, I'm from Cuba.
Is your family still back in Cuba?
Yeah, my family lives in Cuba. My mom, my dad, and my brother.
And how are they doing? How are you doing navigating the distances?
Well, I kind of miss them. I miss them a lot. Yeah, my dad was actually asking me to come back for Christmas. Yeah, so we are trying to arrange that so that I can see them. I haven't seen them in like for a year now. So yeah, I miss them a lot. But they are doing fine so far. Yeah. Oh no, I was going to say that my dad, he works in the Bahamas, so he's still, fortunately, he still has his job. My mom also works in Cuba, and she's still, beside of the COVID conditions, she's still working, and I think they are fine, they are healthy, and they are happy to be together.
Do you have other musicians in your family as well?
Yes, my dad. My dad is a violin teacher, so my dad was my first teacher. He was the one who put the violin in my hands and who introduced me to the world of the music. And also my brother. My brother is 20 years old, and he plays violin and viola.
And what are they telling you about how COVID is affecting them, not just their music practice, but that too, but also their lives in general in Cuba?
Well, it's affecting them a lot. You know, they are used to go out. My dad works in the Bahamas. He lives in Cuba, but he works in the Bahamas. He hasn't been able to go back to the Bahamas. You know, he was supposed to go back there for the fall, and he's doing his classes, his lessons online from Cuba, which is good in a way because he gets to stay with the family, you know, but like for his job, like, you know, like the purpose of teaching his students and all that stuff is a little bit harder. Yeah, like my brother also, he just started his first year of university. You know, it's very rare to start your first year of university like from home. Yeah, it's not very nice. But they are doing all fine. They are just healthy, and they are doing well.
What a hard.
They just would like to have me there too.
What a hard time to be away from home and separated from your family, eh?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So what would you say to other musicians, who are maybe struggling with dealing with the pandemic? It's like, what are your survival tips that you could pass on?
Well, I always try to be super positive, it's normal to have sometimes negative thoughts and to feel sad and down sometimes, but just be positive. I try to find things, the things that made me happy. Exercising has been something that have kept me going through the pandemic, and it helps me keep positive, and it also inspires me to do other things. I start exercising in the morning, and it kind of keeps me going and motivates me to do other things. I like reading, I've been also taking some online courses. I like learning new languages, so I started learning German too, and practicing violin. Being in touch with friends too. So yeah, I just try to keep positive and try to do the things that sometimes I don't have time to do because I'm too busy, playing in orchestra or going to school and yeah.
So you're learning German during So why German?
Well, I love German. Yeah, I love the language and I sing it. Yeah, I got interested in the German because I went to Germany when I was in Cuba. Doing my undergrad, we went for 15 days to a summer camp, and it was great, and I love the city. I love we were in Frankfurt, and we were also in Wiesbaden, and I really love those cities, so I was hoping that someday I could go back there. Also, their education system is great. They have really great musicians, so at some point I was hoping I could, maybe go there for a course or a summer program, and it would be super helpful if I know how to speak the language. And, also we have all these great composers, classical composers that are from Germany, so it would be very helpful if I knew the language.
Well, yeah, you can pronounce Bach properly, right?
Yeah, right.
A lot of German language used in classical music. So
yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to share or something that you, as we're wrapping up this interview?
Well, what I would like to share is that, I hope everyone stays well and people try to be happy and to do things during the pandemic that are going to long-term are going to make them better persons and to stay positive. It doesn't matter what happens. Of course it matters, but to always try to be positive and to think, try to get the best out of each situation we are in life.
That was Yannick Campbell talking to me from her home in Toronto. And now I'm really happy to play for you a couple of musical works performed by our two artists today. Before the show ends, I'll play for you the Prelude for Viola by Benjamin Harry Sajo and performed by Maxime Despax. We started the show with a couple of snippets from that work. I'll play the whole work for you at the end of the show. But before we do that, here's some of Yannick Campbell's music. This is a piano transcription of the Finnish composer John Sibelius's Violin Concerto in D minor, the first movement. The show is a little longer today than usual, but I think you'll agree it's worth the extra time to hear music this good. It just doesn't happen enough in podcasts. Here now is the first movement of the Violin Concerto in D minor, played by Yannick Campbell.
Thank you. These folks at CKUT love their 100% certified organic and fair trade gourmet coffee from Saint-Tropez. Prepared in the heart of Montreal with beans from all over the world, you can find and get your own cup of freshly brewed Saint-Tropez coffee from AUS Snacks on McGill Campus or from Café Saint-Tropez on the corner of Saint-Urbain and Duluth.
I need a fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh cappuccino.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording?
You are?
Oh. Can you press stop?
You are listening to CKUT in Montreal!
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue.